everybody around here likes to start this way. It's our favorite thing to do. You should see us before the show goes on. We just join hands here in the studio, jump up and down like children. Hooray, hooray, we get to do audio open lines the first half hour of the program. Craig can hardly contain himself. I mean, he's putting that audio up so fast. His fingers are flying. It's like sparks are coming from his fingertips. He's so anxious to cue that audio up and play it for you. We've got a very interesting set of pieces to play for you here in the first half hour of Issues, etc. All of them go along a common theme, and I hope we can get to all three in this first half hour. There's a CNN story about two Episcopal priests who want to marry one another. I think they serve the same parish, and they've joined a lawsuit to legalize gay marriage in New Jersey. Staying on that theme, a little bit later in this audio open lines, we'll hear a CBS News report. Also in the Episcopal Church, about a mom of three kids who has decided to become a priest. Now, if you're a Roman Catholic and you're a woman who wants to become a priest, that's news. We talked about that last week. If you're a mom in the Episcopal Church USA who wants to become a priest, that's not really news. They've been ordaining women since 1976, although I dare say this one is a little different. In watching the video, this is a very attractive young mom deciding to become an Episcopal priest. Not typical. And, of course, the two issues are related. Homosexual priests, gay marriage, and the ordination of women. We'll talk about that during audio open lines. And then, if time permits, there's a piece about a gay soldier who has been discharged from the Army. He has skills in Arabic language, which makes him very useful in the war on terror. And he ran afoul of the don't ask, don't tell, don't pursue policy in the Army. We'll be talking about all of that here in the first half hour of Issues, etc. Audio open lines. I'm Todd Wilkin. You can join us 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We have an in-studio email address. It's issuesetc@kfuo.org. In about a half hour, Maggie Carner of LCMS Life Ministries joins us to talk about human cloning. Sounds like bad science fiction. No one's done it yet, but that doesn't mean they won't do it soon. In the second hour of the program, Pastor Peter Ledick joins us. At one point, St. Paul says, Christ, our Passover, has been sacrificed. Therefore, let us keep the feast. What in the world is he talking about? Is he talking about the old Passover? We'll talk about the Lord's Supper in light of the Passover with Pastor Peter Ledick. Then at 4:30, Pastor Brent Kuhlman joins us. Confession and absolution will be our subject. At 5 o'clock, we've got a little bit more audio open lines. Madonna, of course, made news because she had a famous Rome concert yesterday, just miles from the Vatican, where, according to the news reports, she mocked crucifixion, or did a mock crucifixion, on a mirrored cross. And she's raised both the attention and the ire of the Catholic Church. This is just the latest in many jabs she's taken at Roman Catholicism. We'll find out about that during audio open lines from 5 to 5:30. Then at 5:30, Wesley Smith joins us from the Discovery Institute. There's a story in today's St. Louis Post-Dispatch titled, Women's Risk is Stem Cell Issue. You might have seen that. We'll get Wesley's response to the whole issue of egg donation when it comes to the stem cell initiative here in the state of Missouri. Our call in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Well, several years ago, it was one openly gay Episcopal bishop who was making the news. Today, it's two Episcopal priests in New Jersey joining a lawsuit to legalize gay marriage. Here's the story from CNN.
Episcopal priests Dennis Winslow and Mark Lewis estimate they've performed hundreds of weddings, baptisms, and Sunday services.
You made us in your image.
It's a very happy memory.
The Reverend Lewis even ministered to the first President Bush and taught Sunday school to the current president's twin girls.
They were simply a joy.
Yet today, these model pastors have placed themselves at the center of a controversy roiling the Episcopal Church.
The very model of a modern Episcopalian, I don't know what that would be if not someone who fights for justice.
Because Pastor Dennis would like very much to legally marry Pastor Mark.
We see it as a civil right that we're denied, even though we pay first-class taxes. we're treated like second-class citizens. We don't have that freedom to exercise our relationship in a practical way, in a, dare I say, spiritual way.
They have even placed their names on a landmark lawsuit against their home state of New Jersey, seeking the right for all same-sex couples to marry. The state's highest court will be deciding the issue any day now. But even if they are permitted to marry in New Jersey, the Episcopal Church won't recognize the vows. It will only offer a blessing.
The Old Testament speaks very clearly in its purity codes, its moral codes, about how people are to live as far as, you know, as marriage and as regards sexual behavior.
Do you understand that point of view, the people that look at the Bible and say?
I understand it, but they're taking things out of context in the Bible.
At the Episcopal Church's General Convention this year, world leaders asked the U.S. Church to refrain from blessing same-sex unions and electing gay bishops. Now, the controversy over gays threatens a schism in the 77-million-member worldwide Anglican Church.
The issue of gay marriage has effectively pulled the Episcopal Church apart.
That saddens these two pastors. But they say they have faith that both their legal and spiritual cases will eventually resolve in favor of formalizing their 15-year relationship.
Resolution comes with time and with the movement of God's Spirit in a body until things reach a harmony that maybe people can't even imagine.
For now, they will press their legal case in court and count on the understanding of their flock to help them make their case to their church. Delia Gallagher, CNN, Secaucus, New Jersey.
Now, did you think, I'm not that old, I'm 42, but did you think that in your lifetime you would be hearing, as a matter of course, a story about two gay priests, two men, who simply want to marry in the Episcopal Church? Now, some people could have seen it coming. They were wiser than I. If you would have asked me 10 years ago whether I would witness that in my lifetime, I probably, largely out of ignorance, would have said, no, that's bound to happen sooner or later, but it's going to happen later rather than sooner. Well, it's sooner, in fact. And whether you view it as a legal issue of whether or not gay marriage ought to be legalized, or whether you view it as a church issue, whether or not, in the first place, open homosexuals should be serving as priests in any denomination, even the Episcopal Church USA, I imagine a lot of people have been taken off guard by this. Of course, the more you hear about this, the more normal it seems. Now, it's been 30 years in the Episcopal Church USA. Not 30 years since they've been ordaining openly gay men. After all, just 2 years ago, they got around to ordaining the first openly gay bishop. But remember, the operative word when it came to Vicki Jean Robinson and his consecration a couple of years ago in the Episcopal Church USA was openly. They were saying, in effect, we've been ordaining gay bishops for a long time now. It just wasn't open. Now, this relates to the next two pieces in Audio Open Lines. First, back 30 years, 1976, the Episcopal Church USA decided to ordain women to the priesthood. And many within the Episcopal Church USA are now, late, seeing that there's a relationship between what they did in 1976, ordaining women to the priesthood, and what they're contemplating and actually doing, and has now become just kind of a matter of course in the Episcopal Church USA, ordaining open homosexuals to the priesthood. What's the relationship? You say, come on, you can't draw a connection between women and homosexuals. No, you can't. But you can draw a very clear connection between the logic and the way that the church, in this case, the Episcopal Church USA, handles Scripture when it comes to the issue of the ordination of women and the way it handles Scripture in relationship to the ordination of homosexuals. Did you listen to that? Did you hear that where one of the where the interviewer asked one of the gay priests, look, do you understand the objection that people look in the Bible and see prohibitions of homosexuality and an understanding of marriage as a man and a woman? And will object to what you're asking to do? And they'll say, well, yeah, we understand it, but they're taking Scripture out of context. Now, what in the world does that mean? In fact, that argument sounds mighty familiar. If you were in the Episcopal Church USA in 1976, it's the same argument they were making when they said, do you see that St. Paul fairly prohibits women from serving as pastors in the church? And they'd say, well, yeah, we understand that argument, but you're taking Scripture out of context. When Paul seems to be saying that he prohibits women from being pastors, he's actually not saying that. They make arguments like, well, Paul was a man of his times, and you got to understand, Paul couldn't imagine a woman being a pastor. Now, today, being people of our times, we can certainly imagine that. And Paul, you know, let's just show Paul the respect that he's due, but he was a man of his times. Or some would say Paul was a chauvinist. These kind of arguments were made. The same arguments, surprise, surprise, that are being made today for the ordination of homosexuals in mainline church bodies. Well, on the subject of the ordination of women, here's a CBS story. It's hardly a story except for the fact that this is a young, attractive mother with kids who has decided that she wants to become a priest.
Kate Malin has played a lot of roles in her life, actress, wife, then mom. But along the way, something changed for her. CBS News correspondent Mika Brzezinski tells us about the mother who decided it was time to become a father.
I attack Batman.
You can't attack him. You
Kate Malin is a typical mom.
I fly away on my sled.
Overscheduled and sometimes even a little wacky.
Now listen, you.
But after Kate had her boys, her life's mission began to change.
Something very new had been opened in me when I became a mother.
One, two, three, lift your foot up.
That something, so hard to discern at the time, would put Kate on a path toward the priesthood.
When I first detected that call, that tickle that said, maybe you should be doing this, I said, no, like, that's... You couldn't want me.
Despite her confusion, Kate's spiritual journey had begun. And after 9/11, she was sure.
It was just very intense time. And I found that I was stepping into this role of a listener and wanted to be there.
So began the process of becoming an Episcopal priest, though Kate sometimes felt she was a little too human for the job.
It's not that I sense, I may be called to the priesthood, so I better just shape up. I better, kick the caffeine habit and, organize my apartment and somehow be perfect,
right,
so that others will want to be perfect like me. And I think that's a call of the priest, too, is to constantly be in front of your people and be with your people that you serve. You are their servant, and remind them that you are in the midst of the struggle as they are. Remember that you are dust, and to dust.
Now, 7 years after she began the journey, Kate sees how the roles of priest and mom actually work together.
You are the person that loves the people in the congregation.
Once a week, she hosts a gathering of women where she relates directly to the struggles of motherhood.
So I think we all came in with a sense of, I'm not doing it well enough, and therefore I must not be a good Christian, I must not be a good mother. I'm somehow dropping the ball here. And it was such a relief for all of us, myself included, to say, I'm alone.
If she struggles and she's a priest, then I feel much better about my struggles.
Kate and her family live in a seminary in New York City. The boys are starting to understand that their working mom has an important job.
She tells the sermon, she sings songs. He's going to help them eat the bread or drink the wine.
For all the craziness of our life and all the, mommy has to go to church now, mommy's writing a sermon, that there's something they really sort of get about what it is, why I'm doing this, why our whole family is here.
She's accomplishing something big in her life.
I'm going down!
Her little flock at home is a source of daily inspiration, where father mom finds the divine in the day-to-day.
Going into your children's bedroom when they're asleep at last, and just taking a few minutes while they're sleeping to just sit in the bedroom and listen to them breathing. And it was just, thank you, God, for these children. Thank you. And I hear them, they're quiet. quiet. Yeah. They're being quiet now. They're thanking
too.
God for the quiet.
For the early show, I'm Mika Brzezinski, CBS News, New York.
Oh, my God.
And on July 1st, the Reverend Malin took up...
All right, the story concludes there with her placement at a congregation in New York. Now, that is kind of odd because they a couple times they played on the word. The headline was Mother Becomes Father, and then they talked about mother, father, or father, mother. And I'm thinking to myself, that would be kind of odd. Of course, I'm sure they've worked this out in the Episcopal Church USA and the other denominations where they ordain women to the priesthood or to the pastoral office. I'm sure they've worked this out by now, which is what do you call them? I mean, you could call them pastor, I suppose. I mean, you call them pastor. That doesn't make them a pastor. But in the Episcopal Church, you would rightly call your priest father, which is kind of funny if you think about it, if your priest is a lady. So what do they do? I mean, I don't know. Maybe someone knows. Do you call your priest mother? If you call them sister, then you should really be calling your priest brother rather than father. So I don't know. It's just a minor bit of confusion on my part. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. One other intriguing thing in the story was the way she got put on this path. It was 9/11, and she said she felt that tickle. The call, she said, to the priesthood. Now, I'm not sure what she meant by that, but... You know, when guys show up here at Concordia Seminary, we broadcast on the campus of Concordia Seminary here in Clayton. When they show up here to study for the pastoral ministry, I seriously doubt the first question that they get asked when they are applying for classes is, have you felt that tickle? We really should not ordain based upon a tickle. Not a good idea. There may be something more substantial to that, and maybe the first thing we want to ask, I know it's passé since 1976 among the Episcopalians, but you might want to ask, should even a person like this be ordained and pursue ordination? Of course, that's a question that the Episcopal Church answered 30 years ago. Yes, women ought to pursue ordination. You know how it started, though. Go back and look at this. It did not start with, just out of the blue, the Episcopal Church USA one day saying, hey, you know what? Should we ordain women? Yeah, let's do that. No, it started like so many things start in the church. The same way gay ordination started in the Episcopal Church USA. Bishops just started doing it. Remember, last week we talked about those U.S. Catholic bishops who have allegedly, according to the story, secretly ordained women to be bishops. And then these bishops last week went ahead and openly ordained a whole another group of women to be priests and deacons in the Catholic Church. Now, the bishops who originally ordained the first women there, their names have not been disclosed. Apparently, they're not going to be disclosed until they die for fear of excommunication. That's what the news story is. So no one knows who they are. But this is how it begins. It begins with someone just doing it, secretly, under the table, whatever. And then later, the question is put to the denomination of the church body, you know, we've been doing this for so many years. We really should find a way of at least recognizing this or formalizing this. I mean, after we don't want all these, kind of ad hoc female priests out there. Let's recognize them. And that's how it happened in 1976. It started out with don't ask, don't tell. Kind of like in the army. Well, here's a story. This one comes from ABC News. About a guy in the Army, Sergeant Copus, who was living happily as a gay man in the Army under don't ask, don't tell, don't pursue, and this is how it worked out for him.
He was a decorated Army sergeant with special skills used specifically in the War on Terror, an exemplary officer. He thought he had a long career ahead of him in the military, and then he was discharged because he is gay. And this morning, he is stepping forward to tell his story. ABC's Jake Tapper has it. Jake?
Good morning, Bill. Well, the policy against gays and lesbians serving openly in the military, known as Don't Ask, Don't Tell, was signed into law by President Clinton in 1993. Since then, about 11,000 servicemen and women have been discharged, including, recently, Sergeant Blue Copus, one of the few Arabic speakers in military intelligence.
Growing up in Johnson City, Tennessee, Blue Copus was inspired by stories from his father's military days. But it wasn't until September 11th that the then 26-year-old enlisted.
I just felt like it was a duty that I needed to fulfill to my country.
At the Defense Language Institute in California, he learned Arabic and soon began working in military intelligence.
It's indisputable that the work that my specific job does is one of the most important jobs of the military. It's very difficult to keep tabs on all the different enemies.
One problem, Copus is gay, and the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy meant his sexuality could get him kicked out.
What did you think that Don't Ask, Don't Tell meant?
I was not allowed to tell anyone, and I had to maintain my privacy and maintain a professionalism in the workplace.
Copus says he did just what the military required. He did not tell anyone at work he was gay and assumed no one there would ever have reason to ask him about it. Last year, someone got into Copus's personal email account and sent emails indicating he's gay to his commanders, noting that the emails belonged to someone in the 82nd Airborne Division's All-American Chorus.
So the commanders or the leaders of the chorus brought us into the hallway and asked us, or let us know, we know one of you are gay. Who is it? We need to know so we can put an end to this.
Copus did not admit he was the one, but soon they were all asked about those emails.
I was asked different questions. Do I know of anyone who thinks I'm homosexual, or do I associate with others who are homosexual? Am I involved in the community theater?
What do you mean, are you involved in the community theater?
They were trying to make connections between the emails. There were some questions that I declined to answer that I didn't think would help in finding the informant.
Now, all this sergeant's trying to do here, whatever you think of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, Don't Pursue, is abide by the policy that he signed up for. He signed up under the policy Don't Ask, Don't Tell, Don't Pursue. That is the official policy of the U.S. Army and the military in the United States, if you're homosexual. And he says, look, I kept it secret. No one asked. I didn't tell, and no one pursued. Now he's being asked, and he's trying not to tell. That's the policy, right? The whole thing is just assume that no one is homosexual in the Army. Just assume no one is homosexual in the Army, and there's no problem with it. Unless, of course, you find out someone is, and then you might have to do something about it. And this is what happened with this particular sergeant. Someone found out. Someone outed him. Well, when we come back, we'll hear the rest of the story from ABC News. It's called Army Discharges Gay Arabic Speaker. And I have some thoughts on this. The dangers of don't ask, don't tell, don't pursue in the church. You know, that's how we get Vicki Jean Robinson as the first openly gay bishop in the Episcopal Church USA. It begins with don't ask, don't tell, don't pursue. But it ends with an openly gay bishop. We'll talk about that when we come back from this break. It's Audio Open Lines, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Here are some subjects that are surely of interest to you. Living and dying, what is the church? Church and state, God's grace, faith, the sacraments. Well, our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for August provides insight into all of these issues from the perspective of Martin Luther. It's titled, Luther's World of Thought. Concordia Publishing House is the publisher. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Or you can read a chapter from Luther's World of Thought on our website, issuesetc.org. How did the social, political, and religious climate of the 16th century influence Martin Luther and the Reformation? Luther's World of Thought begins with Luther's life and times and ends with his death and his legacy. It's a hardcover book. The cost is $29.99 plus shipping and handling. Luther's World of Thought. the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for August, issuesetc.org or 1-800-325-3040.
Where Have All the Women Gone? A Disturbing Report from China.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
The Chinese government has decided it will not prohibit abortions used to prevent the birth of girl babies, even though sex selection abortions have contributed to a stark gender imbalance that is creating a host of social problems. China now has 119 boys for every 100 girls, a gender imbalance far from the normal ratio seen in industrialized nations across the globe. In addition to the tragedy of abortion, the gender imbalance has another fallout: the rise of massive sex trafficking and the kidnapping of teenage girls to be forced into marriage.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. To join us in our battle for life, visit our website at sba-list.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. The office memo. As often as not, the office memo is despised. Sometimes it's a coward's way out. Sometimes it is self-serving, leaving a paper trail to protect yourself. The memo was an obvious part of office intrigue. In 74 BC, the Roman statesman Cicero came back from a distinguished tour of duty in Sicily. He assumed that people knew of his service, and they should have, but they didn't. Some didn't even know he had been out of Rome. Cicero learned a lesson from that. He wrote, "Once I had realized that the Roman people was rather deaf but sharp-eyed, I stopped worrying about what the world heard about me. From that day on, I took care to be seen in person every day." Years later, St. Paul had a similar experience. He knew that people reacted differently to his letters, or should I say to his memos, than to his presence. So he often wrote of his desire to see people in person. Paul's sincerity is proved by all the traveling he did throughout the Mediterranean world. Now, sometimes office memos have to be sent. But shouldn't love prompt more personal conversation in your office and fewer memos? Face-to-face or phone-to-phone, that might just be your Christian way of improving the workplace climate. I'm Dale Meyer.
Did you know the Young Zoo Friends are a group of professionals in their 20s and 30s who support the future success of the zoo through volunteerism, fundraising, educational, and social opportunities? And on Wednesdays, now through August 23rd, the Young Zoo Friends' popular Jammin' at the Zoo event will take place from 6 until 10 p.m. with great live music and wine tasting. Ages 21 and up only, please. Become a member of the Young Zoo Friends.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. A little bit more audio open lines for just a few minutes. Finish up this ABC News story on the discharged sergeant, homosexual sergeant, and then we're going to pick up the conversation with Maggie Carner of LCMS Life Ministries and Human Cloning. And then, in about a half hour, second hour of the program, Christ Our Passover with Pastor Peter Ledick. He made a presentation at last month's Higher Things Youth Conference titled Christ Our Passover. It's coming up in about 25 minutes here on Issues Etc. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Remember, the issue here is how don't ask, don't tell doesn't even work so well in the Army. This sergeant, now that he's been honorably discharged with pay and all that, is working to try and overturn that policy. He says, look, it was probably a good idea 10, 15 years ago when it was instituted, but now it's not really necessary, and it isn't work. It certainly did not work out in his case. And I can't help but think of don't ask, don't tell in the church, where pastors don't ask, they don't tell, they don't pursue. They simply assume because people are sitting in Bible class or in church nodding their heads that all is well there. And it's as dangerous, more dangerous in the church than it even is in the military. Here's more of the ABC News story.
Later, that ended up hurting me.
In a written statement, COPUS's then-commanding officer, Lieutenant Colonel James Zellmer, says, "When the allegations of Sergeant COPUS's homosexual conduct came to my attention, I appointed an impartial officer to conduct an investigation. The evidence clearly indicated that Sergeant Kopus had engaged in homosexual acts and made statements in a public forum indicating a propensity and intent to engage in homosexual acts. Last December, Kopus was honorably discharged because he's gay, because of this anonymous emailer.
Who could this person have possibly been? Is this an ex-boyfriend? Is this somebody?
I have no idea. I've racked my brain for months, a year now, trying to find out who this is.
A recent study indicates the military has dismissed almost 800 gay or lesbian service people with critical abilities, including 300 with important language skills and 55 who speak Arabic. Kopa says Don't Ask, Don't Tell may have made sense 13 years ago, but it does not today.
I think, especially now, of all times, the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy hurts the war on terror.
Kopa says that even though he feels the military violated its own policy by asking when he was not telling, he was discharged with full benefits, so he is not going to sue. He says he wants to become a voice for those servicemen and women to serve openly. He says he feels the military is ready for it.
Now, you can probably come to the conclusion that Don't Ask, Don't Tell, Don't Pursue is the best policy for the U.S. military to adopt at this particular time. You might even conclude it isn't. It doesn't really make much difference. I think people can disagree on that. You got to have all the facts at hand. But I think there's no doubt that Don't Ask, Don't Tell, Don't Pursue is not a good idea in the church. But sad to say, it is the modus operandi when it comes to many things in the church today, not just homosexuality. How is it that the Episcopal Church USA or the other denominations that now ordain, either openly or secretly, active homosexuals to their priesthood or their pastoral ministry? How is it that they started? They started with Don't Ask, Don't Tell, Don't Pursue in their seminaries among those who are going to be ordained. And what have they ended up with? In the case of the Episcopal Church USA, Bishop Gene Robinson, first openly gay bishop. One thing leads to another. Now, there are pastors who in their congregations practice Don't Ask, Don't Tell, Don't Pursue, not just with the issue of homosexuality. Oh, you might be able to make the argument that statistically the chances are you don't have active and unrepentant homosexuals in your congregation. And that's a big issue. It's a key issue, active, unrepentant homosexuals in your congregation. And statistically, you might say, nah, so chances are we don't. But there are many other issues of sin in Christian congregations that get the same Don't Ask, Don't Tell, Don't Pursue treatment. Cohabitation. Adultery. What people actually believe. When the people are sitting in adult Bible class and they're shaking their heads and they're nodding their heads, and the pastor assumes, okay, now everyone's silent, and silence in court means yes, or everyone is nodding their head, that means that they agree, that we all believe the same thing. That's a big assumption. That really is, in a lot of ways, Don't Ask, Don't Tell, Don't Pursue. So the pastor who refuses to do polemics, to say, look, just because I kind of mentioned homosexuality and I didn't get any hands raised, we're all on the same page, or I mentioned cohabitation or any of these other things and I didn't get any hands raised, or I mentioned the resurrection and no one objected. Don't think for a second that because you have a policy of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, Don't Pursue, that there isn't a problem there. For the remainder of this hour, Maggie Carner is our guest. She's a regular guest here on the program, director of LCMS Life Ministries for LCMS World Relief. She joins us to talk about human cloning. Sounds like bad science fiction, but it might be more than fiction soon. Maggie, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, it was just last week, I think, that I was reading a story in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and your name came up. How were you contacted for this story on the whole Missouri stem cell issue?
Well, President Jerry Kishnick had recently sent out a news release thanking President Bush for his recent veto regarding federal funding of embryonic stem cell research. And now that the state of Missouri is considering a stem cell initiative that will be on the ballot in November, the reporter was interested in finding out how the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod stood on that issue. And he called me to see what was going on with the Missouri Synod.
You were quoted in the story from last week saying when it comes to this issue, especially in Missouri, it is ethically and theologically unacceptable to destroy life, the life of one innocent human being, for the life of another. What's the point here when it comes to human cloning and embryonic stem cell research?
The point that I was trying to make to the reporter is that oftentimes the general public, when they hear, especially anything that has to do with stem cell research, often they need to remember that there's two different types of stem cell research, and we need to differentiate between the two. Unfortunately, that article in the paper didn't do a very good job of doing that. But there is adult stem cell research, which we as Christians can wholeheartedly and do support. But then we have grave problems with embryonic stem cell research. And what I wanted to communicate to the reporter and to the readers is that when you're dealing with embryonic stem cell research, we're dealing with destruction of human life, the embryonic life of a human being. And when you're doing research with these embryos, it necessarily results in the death of that embryo. Now, the goals and the motivation may be altruistic, finding cures. We all want to find cures for debilitating diseases. But we cannot ethically or theologically support the destruction of one innocent human being simply based on their development, their level of development, or their location, that they happen to be in a petri dish instead of implanted in a woman's womb.
You're also quoted talking about the quote-unquote fanciful language of the advocates of human cloning for biomedical research. What do you mean by fanciful language?
Well, even the scientists who originally discovered stem cells have now sort of retraced their steps and have cautioned many people. They're concerned, they're alarmed at the hype, for lack of a better term, on oftentimes in the publicity that you hear regarding embryonic stem cell research, that cures are just around the corner. All they need is a little bit of funding, and we're going to have cures, you know, to cure Alzheimer's or Parkinson's tomorrow. It's really, that's unrealistic. Right now, even with all the hype, there's been no treatments or cures with embryonic stem cell research at all. There's not even been any human trials at this point. The real results are happening with adult stem cell research. So it's not a very honest assertion to tell the general public that these cures are just around the corner. Even well-meaning scientists will say that they're anywhere from 5 to 10 years off.
Well, especially when we talk about human cloning for biomedical research, which is the subject of the Missouri Coalition for Life-Saving Cures initiative that the voters are going to be looking at here, even before embryonic stem cell research has shown any kind of fruitful cures at all, as you pointed out, it hasn't yet. We haven't even managed to clone a human being, as far as anyone knows, have we?
No, and the point being, and you brought up one interesting thing, you rightly asserted that this initiative in Missouri is about cloning. And the problem is that the publicity, the pro-initiative publicity that many people see, the direct mail pieces that come across their mailbox or the TV commercials, try to avoid that issue. You will never read the word cloning in association with the people that support that initiative. They try to mask the language, and they call it SCNT, somatic cell nuclear transfer, which is actually the same thing as human cloning. Cloning is cloning. It doesn't matter whether that embryo is left in a petri dish and destroyed or whether that clone is implanted in a woman's uterus. So that's noticeably absent from any of the communication that you'll see regarding this initiative. You also won't hear the word embryo used, because most people recognize that when you use the word embryo, you're talking about a human. So So there's some real disingenuous language that they are employing in an effort to sort of mask the intention of this piece of legislation.
I'm thinking about a nine-minute infomercial that the Missouri Coalition for Life-Saving Cures put out to promote the initiative that, they've managed to get on the Missouri ballot here. And I think they mentioned the word embryonic once or twice at the beginning of this nine-minute infomercial, and then very deftly switch from embryonic to early. They'll talk about embryonic stem cells, and then within one breath, they switch to early stem cells. What are they trying to avoid?
I believe that they're trying to avoid the language that goes along with cloning. They don't want to use the word cloning. They don't want to use the language embryo because most people realize that's human.
The initiative claims, and virtually every one of their print pieces, virtually every one of their television or radio pieces tries to drive home the point that this initiative in November here in Missouri is going to ban human cloning. And most people, when they think human cloning, Maggie, think cloning a human being and planting it in a womb and bringing forth some sort of full-born cloned human being. They don't know what that will mean, but they know they don't want it. And so many have signed the petition, and many are planning to vote for the Missouri Coalition for Life-Saving Cures initiative. What's wrong with this?
There's a lot wrong with that. And I can fully understand the well-meaning person who hears that language and says, yeah, I'm against cloning. I'll sign that. Or will vote that many of our well-meaning people have already signed the petition. And, now that it'll be on the ballot in November, many people will vote for it because the language that they see, is really a lot different than the language that is actually written, let's say in the fine print of the actual verbiage of the constitutional amendment. And you need to remember that this is a Missouri constitutional amendment. It will change the Missouri Constitution not only to allow for SCNT and to allow for stem cell research, embryonic stem cell research, but it actually allows for unrestricted cloning, because what they've done in the language of this buried per se, in the language of this initiative, is they've redefined what cloning actually is. But any scientist will tell you that whenever the chromosomes from the egg are put together with the chromosomes from any type of when you have 46 chromosomes put together, whether it's in a petri dish or whether it's and done with a needle or whether it's done in the uterus, it is a human being. And whether it's gone through the natural fertilization process with a male sperm cell and a female egg, or whether you do it through SCNT, it doesn't matter whether it's implanted or not. You still have a single cell human being that is often growing. And the idea, the reason that stem cell proponents are wanting this amendment so desperately is because it allows for unrestricted cloning in the state of Missouri. What I would encourage people to do is to read the fine print. I just had some representatives for Missouri Roundtable for Life that had gave our Sanctity of Human Life Committee a wonderful presentation this morning, and they passed out line for line a critique of this stem cell research initiative. And it is available for download on the internet at www.moroundtable.org. You can read the actual fine print of the initiative. Of course, you won't read that on the ballot because it's very extensive and very complex, but I encourage people to go to this and please read through it and then read their critique. They make it very readable to the average layperson and will clearly define what this initiative will do. It's even if you're not a Christian, even if you're not a religious person in any way, shape, or form, you don't even have to share my pro-life views. But if you read this line by line and understand the legal implications for Missouri citizens and taxpayers, it's a very dangerous initiative. It can cause long-term financial chaos in the state of Missouri. There's some real serious problems, and I want people to read this for themselves. I don't want people to vote against this initiative just because their pastor tells them, or just because KFUO tells them, or me or anybody else. I want them. People aren't sheep, and I believe that Missouri voters are intelligent, smart, savvy people. And I know when they read this initiative word for word, their antennas will go up and they'll know this is bad news for Missouri.
See, that goes to the very heart of what we've been hearing, and that is people appreciate the fact that we've been talking about this since it came to the fore. They appreciate that we revisit it, that we try to explain it as simply as possible. But I think I heard just last week from a colleague who said, look, there's got to be a better way of making this plain to the average person, because I hear about it on the radio and the language confuses me. The various definitions that are all tossed out and proffered confuse me. The jargon confuses me. And I want to have clear thinking on this before I go in and cast a vote in Missouri.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know that Missouri people are able to educate themselves, and they have to take it upon themselves to do that. Make themselves aware of what's going on out there. Go to there are two websites in particular that I recommend that will give them a lot of information, valuable information. The one I just mentioned, moroundtable.org and www.nocloning.org. And both of these websites, we're all working in tandem to make sure that Missouri voters get the real skinny on what's happening in this initiative.
It seems, Maggie, that the advocates of this Missouri cloning for biomedical research are depending on two things when it comes to the public. They're depending upon the public's ignorance about the real issues here. And their modus operandi there is to reinforce that ignorance, or actually to capitalize on it with all their, what you say, fanciful language. But they're also depending upon endorsement from famous people, former Senator Danforth, his brother, former leader at Washington University, big money interests, foundations. The list goes on and on and on, Maggie.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think they're using the emotion. They're playing the emotion card, too. You know, everybody wants a cure. Everybody's got, an uncle or an aunt or someone who's dealing with a debilitating disease. My father lived as a quadriplegic for a large part of the end of his life, and I'll tell you, I would have loved to see him out walking in his vegetable garden again. You know, there's nobody that doesn't want a cure for these tragic diseases. But I cannot ethically support the taking of an innocent life to offer a cure for someone else just because they're at a different stage of development. Again, that's my pro-life view. Because I'm a diehard pro-life person as a Christian. But I think that you, like I said, you don't have to be pro-life to really be concerned about the legalities and the way that this initiative is written and crafted. It's deceptive, and it's dangerous.
Someone thinks about cloning in general, and they say, look, what difference does it make? Because it is science fiction. No one's been able to do it. The attempts have all failed. It'll never happen. Why are we worrying about this?
It's not science fiction. We're already cloning animals at this point. And I have no doubt that we will be able to clone humans at some point. It may not ever be a safe process, but that's not what the scientists are interested in. They're not interested in safe cloning practices. They're interested in cloning humans for expendable reasons, to use them as research subjects, to use embryos as research subjects. They're also interested in genetically altering humans to possibly enhance humans. And I have no doubt in my mind that this is a possibility in the future.
Finally, someone says, look, doesn't the Bible say someplace that unless the embryo implants in a woman's womb, we're not really talking about life? We might be talking about a pre-embryo or potential human life, but they try and make the biblical argument that the embryo has to be implanted in the mother's womb for us to consider it or to protect this as life.
Let me just start with Psalm 51. where it says, surely I was sinful at birth, sinful from the time my mother conceived me. That's pretty specific. If we were if we were sinful from the moment of conception, we were logically a person from conception. So we're not talking about implantation. A lot of pro-abortion people these days are trying to redefine, and pro-cloning people are trying to redefine a person becoming a person when it's implanted. There are even physicians now who are advocating that we say that pregnancy only begins after implantation, not at conception. Any embryologist will tell you that life begins at conception. When we say the Apostles' Creed, we talk about Jesus being conceived by the Holy Spirit. And, you know, I wonder, well, why was that stuck in there? Why do we say that every Sunday? Why do we talk about Jesus being conceived by the Holy Spirit? Because he became human at that moment. He became our God-man at that moment. If you look back in the historic church, clear back for centuries, we've celebrated on March 25th the Annunciation of our Lord. The moment when Jesus was conceived, when he entered the human race for us. And that's pretty clear that our incarnate Jesus was a zygote, just like you and me. So the implantation argument doesn't fly with me.
Folks, you can help Pastor Matt Harrison and LCMS World Relief defend life from beginning to end by making a donation to LCMS Life Ministries. You can donate by calling LCMS World Relief. Their toll-free number is 1-888-930-4438. You can earmark a donation for LCMS Life Ministries, 1-888-930-4438. Or you can go to our website, issuesetc.org. On the left-hand side of the homepage, there's the links. Click there, scroll down, and you'll find a direct link to Maggie Carner and LCMS Life Ministries. Their toll-free number again, 1-888-930-4438. Now, Maggie mentioned two other websites for information purposes that I would remind you of. Write them down. One's called moroundtable.org, moroundtable.org, or www.nocloning.org for information on the Missouri Coalition for Life-Saving Cures, what it really does, in fact, say. Maggie Carner is director of LCMS Life Ministries for LCMS World Relief. Maggie, thanks for being our guest.
Hey, thanks for having me and for all that you do.
Sure. When we come back from this break, we've got hour two ahead, and we're going to start out talking about Christ, our Passover. Is Paul saying more than just kind of drawing an allegorical connection between Jesus and the Passover lamb? What is Paul saying when he calls Christ our Passover? And when he talks about celebrating the feast, we'll answer that right after this.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM 850 KFUO. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.